Wednesday night, very late edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. Three games to get to today, starting off with the Houston Rockets overcoming Russell Westbrook's 51 points and 43 shots. 115-111 over the Thunder. Also got to get to a nice victory for the Wizards as they take it to a 2-0 series lead despite a foul-marred contest, 109-101 over the Hawks. And then the Warriors absolutely destroying Portland, 110-81 in the nightcap, a game that Danny and I were at. We're brought to you today by a new sponsor, audible.com. Turn your time where your hands are occupied but your ears are free into something more with a free trial at Audible. Go to audible.com/capspace to start now. And also CISO. Go to CISO.com right now and sign up for 2 weeks free using the promo code CAPSPACE at checkout. All right, let's get rolling here with what I'm sure was the main event tonight, a game I wish we'd been able to do Twitter NBA show for, just because of a performance by Russell Westbrook that in some ways doubled down on everything that he has been in this crazy year in which he will likely win MVP.
In the first three quarters, Westbrook had 36 points, 9 rebounds, 11 assists on 13-25 shooting, only 1-4 from three. And then in the fourth quarter, 15 points, 4-18 from the field, 1-7 from three.
And only 2 assists as well, which was perhaps even the bigger problem there.
On only 3 made baskets by any other guy.
Yeah. I went back and watched some of Russ's shots here, and I thought that the disparity between the first half and the second half was a huge one. And we'll get, there's a lot of nuance to his performance, which is surprising to say because, you know, he basically just, his approach just seems to be to like batter himself against the castle doors until it either falls or he knocks himself out. But in the first half, I counted him taking 2 awful shots. Although he was also bailed out on 3 other awful shots by fouls as he was taking jumpers. In the second half, I counted him taking 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 terrible shots. Admittedly, that's subjective, especially for a guy like Russ who takes a lot of contested jumpers. You know, what's a okay shot for him and what's like a really terrible shot? But he definitely got real selfish in the second half. And I think that's pretty much undeniable. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, he did have 2 assists on 3 made baskets in that fourth quarter by other guys, but that's not enough.
No, it's not. And just to give you an idea of how they're playing, and again, this is something that we've talked about a lot, especially down the end of games. They have, you know, it's been ride or die with Russ taking every shot in the fourth quarter. And I think he had like, you know, a 66% usage rate in the fourth quarter, Fred Katz said. The Thunder had only 238 passes in this game, despite a high number of possessions. And to give you some perspective, usually the lowest team in the league will have about 270 passes per game. It wouldn't shock me if 238 passes was like, you know, one of like the very lowest marks in any game this season. But, you know, I would have to go back and check that. But that's just based on looking at that stat every once in a while. And you know, he's asked to initiate everything, and other than Victor Oladipo, there's really nobody else on this team who can dribble, so that's definitely a problem, or at least hope of doing anything off the dribble that's going to develop something good. So that's an issue as well. But overall, I mean, they put up 111 points on 98 possessions in this game. They had a 113 offensive rating for the game. So despite his crazy line, which was 51 points on 52 shooting possessions, 13 assists, also had the Holy Grail triple double in rebounds as well, his team put up a really efficient game. And part of, you know, we noted the 238 passes, they also only turned it over 7 times in the whole game, and he only turned it over 4 times, which is incredible considering, you know, the 43 shot attempts that he took and the number of assists that he had. So, you know, there is a little bit more to it here, but certainly it's clear that when it's not quite working for him, it can look very, very ugly for this Thunder team. And that's what happened in the fourth quarter.
And it's also true that it looked ugly for the Thunder when Westbrook was not on the floor. This was not some sort of circumstance where the other part of the story was different, or, oh, what if, you know, what if these other guys had gotten their shots? Victor Oladipo, 4-14 from the field. McDermott was a surprising 4-5.
Yeah, we should talk about that. Oladipo now was 1-12 in the first game, so that makes him 5-26 for the series, and I think he is 1-13 from three.
Robertson was making some twos, including a putback, one of the only shots Russell Westbrook didn't take down the stretch, but the Thunder still have that identity problem of just having other players who are capable, and there were parts of it that did look better in some of the rotational issues, but they don't have enough outside of him, and he is too comfortable taking those bad shots.
Well, here's the other thing, you know, you mentioned when he was off the floor, they lost this game by 4, and he was plus 11. Now, that's a little misleading because they were down by like 6 or 8 down the very end, and then, you know, they just kind of hit some lucky shots in the last minute when the Rockets weren't really trying that hard and had a couple of turnovers. So, you know, that's probably a little bit misleading. But, you know, if this were a 40-minute game that Russell Westbrook could play the entire game of, maybe they win it. You know, it's still, Samaje Christen was negative 15 in 7 minutes. So maybe this is, you know, it's hard to argue that this isn't an effective way to play when he's plus 11 for a game. Now, there was a marked difference, as I noted, with the awful shot counter of how he played in the first half and the second half. And part of that, I think, is, you know, just that he has this mentality that he has to try harder, which trying harder means taking more shots. Or it means that they're also going to play with all these defenders on the floor, which they did down the stretch. I mean, because it was tied really until there were about 3-4 minutes left in the game. And then Houston went on a nice run as they struggled and Russ was taking some horrible jumpers and Houston really defended him pretty well during that time period. But, you know, it basically gets to the point when some of these lineups they put out there that he just can't attack the basket anymore. He was so good attacking the basket in the first half, and when he can attack the basket and there's some space, then he can actually like pass to guys too, which, you know, he didn't really have that option throughout much of the fourth quarter. I mean, we can get into a little bit more of kind of what the game flow is, but I did think it too was very instructive that they had a great run at the start of the second quarter when they brought out a lineup really for the first time this season that I can recall. It was Oladipo, who, you know, at least can pretend to make a shot, even though he hasn't in this series. Doug McDermott, who you mentioned was fantastic with his offense, although he was still -7 in 14 minutes. And Kyle Singler, who's white, so they feel like they have to guard him a little bit out by the three-point line. And then Steven Adams, a great role man. And Russ played very unselfishly with that unit. He dimed up McDermott a couple of times for threes, another time for they're running like a little horn set with a pick and roll with Adams and Russ on one side and McDermott at the other elbow flashing up to the top of the key, and Houston really had trouble guarding that. So I do think it's possible that he can play less selfishly if he has more around him. He ignored McDermott a couple of times when he was open in the second half, but, you know, at that time I think he was just like, all right, you know, I gotta go and do this myself for better or for worse, and it was for worse.
One of the other stories for me of this game, and it feels bad that we've spent so much time talking about the team who lost, but there were a few situations where Donovan, I thought he did a better job with his rotations, but there were a few what I call no chance lineups, and that idea is really where there isn't a thing for them to hang their hat on offensively or defensively without Westbrook on the floor. Samaje, Sabonis was in for a little bit of that time. Kyle Singler.
He only played 2 minutes, oddly, but it seemed like he played more than that. But you're saying Singler. I mean, I don't know about Singler. I guess he just felt like, hey, you know, we needed someone who can kind of pretend to shoot. But yeah, and Singler, I think, actually, you know, is a little bit underrated as a defender, as long as he doesn't have to guard, like, you know, a point guard out in space.
Yeah, which he had to do a couple times. But yeah, just there were some lineups there that didn't have much of a shot, and Houston really knew how to do that. And Houston has a very deep squad with a lot of capable offensive players, and so if you put a lineup out there against them that isn't going to do much, they're going to go on a run. And that's part of how Samaje had such a bad plus minus game.
Yeah, that's true too. I mean, I still think I was glad that he only played Samaje 7 minutes. At least he didn't play him next or Westbrook this time,
and no Norris Cole.
Yeah, no Norris Cole. They definitely made some improvements, right? Cantor only played 8 minutes, or I guess we should just call him can't play him, like K-A-N-T, can't play him, because Donovan had that video where he was saying that to Mo Cheeks on the bench. So they put can't play him out there for 4 minutes, just basically the 4 minutes that Harden rested in the first half, and which really helped a lot. And then it was weird though in the second half that when Adams got in foul trouble, because they tried to run out that same lineup at the start of the fourth quarter, and then Adams got in foul trouble, and rather than go to Taj Gibson at center, they just went with first Sabonis at center, and then they went with Cantor, and that really made no sense at all.
And then they also compounded that by, it's not like Taj Gibson was playing such heavy minutes late in the game that they were needing to save him. They ended up turning, as Donovan has a couple times in the late time in the season, to Jeremy Grant. So if you're not going to rely heavily on Taj Gibson, you know, just use him as that gap filler and handle it from there.
So a few other things I guess we can say about OKC before we turn to the game flow and also give Houston their just due. Don't worry, Houston fans. You'll get plenty of love. Russ was only 5 out of 14 at the rim. And I mean, 14 shots at the rim for a guard is just an incredible number. But you know, a lot of those are in transition. He flies at the rim so hard that it's just really impossible for him to get touch on a lot of these shots. You know, and if he gets a little bit of a bump, you know, he doesn't have any kind of a floater game. You know, he's not even really necessarily going to, you know, he's just going 1,000 miles an hour at the rim. And a lot of times he'll either leave it short or it's just going to carry him too hard off the backboard. Like, it's just naturally really hard when you're flying that hard at the rim, especially off of 2 feet the way he does. To have much touch on it. And you know, he's always shot a low percentage at the rim, and this game was no exception. I thought that Clint Capela really changed the game quite a bit at the start of the fourth quarter when they had to bring Russ back in because they were getting killed again. You know, he didn't get much of a rest, and Capela actually stopped OKC drivers, including Russ, 4 straight times within like the first 3 minutes of the fourth quarter. And then Russ got a little gun shy of trying to go inside, especially once they went to the no spacing lineups. And then it was just terrible jumper after terrible jumper. And, you know, he wasn't able to keep up with a Houston team that really started heating up from 3-point range finally in that fourth quarter.
Capela was also able to impact plays without blocking shots. He did have 3 blocks in that fourth quarter, 4 overall, but he changed them. He was in the middle of a lot of different plays, and as you said, one of the biggest impacts of a good rim protector, which Capela was at least in that fourth quarter, is deterrence. And that deterrence forced Westbrook to become the player that is kind of his worst case scenario in some of these circumstances.
Yeah, I think that's right. OKC's defense was better, I thought, than in game one. They at least stopped Houston centers. They at least took something away. And moreover, they also held Houston to fewer 3-point attempts than they did in game one, although Houston shot better at 38%, 11 out of 29. But then they just couldn't keep James Harden off the foul line. And Harden was 18 out of 20, 7 out of 17 from the field, 3 of 7 on threes. He had 35 points, only 8 assists. And Houston only having 20 assists. I mean, I thought that was pretty decent for OKC as well. So they did make some baby steps defensively. A lot of that was helped by just not playing Cantor and, you know, just having better pick and roll defenders out there. And I think just getting used to them as well. From Houston's standpoint, Ryan Anderson has really struggled in this series. He had 4 points, 0 of 7 from 3. We declared him back from that ankle injury. I don't know if that has to do with it or just simply that he's been off, but they definitely need something for him. And Anderson was negative 18 in this game as well. He provides a place for them to attack, you know, in pick and roll coverage as well. So that'll be interesting. I think we'll see more of, you know, Trevor Ariza at the four. Ariza also was excellent guarding Westbrook. I liked, especially once Westbrook went into jumper mode, I liked them going with a little bit more length on him, Ariza, knowing that if they blew by him, you know, Beverly is good, but he's easier for Westbrook to post up on those right block post ups where he likes to go over his left shoulder. And you know, Westbrook can also shoot over him, whereas Ariza is really going to challenge those. And then they knew they had plenty of help at the rim because, you know, there are these really shooting challenged lineups out there for OKC.
And while, of course, some of the attribution goes to Oklahoma City playing some bad bench players, I thought Houston's bench was very important in this game. Both Lou Williams and Eric Gordon were able to get their shot much more reliably than before. And I thought Nene was not as good as Capela. I thought Capela, even though the plus minuses go the other way, I thought Capela played a nice game. Nene was another positive contributor, and Houston only played 8 guys in this one again.
Yeah, I mean, there's nobody really off the bench that you would expect, but each of their bench guys played over 20 minutes, you know, and you mentioned that Gordon with 22 points, Lou Williams with 21, those guys were both 8 of 14 from the field, and they combined for 6 out of 10 on threes as well, so hitting some big shots. And Patrick Beverly had another sterling game as well. He had 15 points, 6 of 9 from the field, hit maybe one of the biggest shots, a right corner three that put Houston up late as well. So that was very solid for the Rockets. I mean, and it was a good comeback. I mean, they trailed 86-74 late in the third quarter, and then Westbrook went out, and by the time he came back in, the lead was basically gone already, even though he'd only sat for like 2 minutes.
How does what happened in this game, whether you want to focus more on the first half where Westbrook played so well, or the fourth quarter where he struggled and the Rockets played very well, in totality, how did this change the way, or did it change the way that you feel about this series?
I feel better about it for OKC because I think Donovan made most of the adjustments that we suggested for him. I still think he should dump Kristen completely and go with Oladipo at backup point guard, but you know, it's not like Oladipo has been killing it here either. As bad as he's been, but at least you know the other team respects him. So I like that. He minimized Kanter, got McDermott some more playing time. I think he could even play even more. But you saw how much more competitive they would be when he kind of excised the low-hanging fruit from some of the mistakes that he's made. Now, will we see Westbrook get a little bit more egalitarian at home? I think that especially if they can get a little bit of a lead, he feels more comfortable, you know, getting more people involved. And will Donovan also go to get more shooting on the floor? I mean, they have gone with Robertson to be sure, but Harden, they really have not stopped him at all. They fouled him a ton, you know, so maybe Robertson played 37 minutes and he did have 12.7 offensive rebounds, which was incredible as OKC racked up 17 offensive rebounds as a team. And then maybe if Steven Adams could stay out of foul trouble, he fouled out in 27 minutes. And he was plus 18 in this one. He was a key figure. Obviously, his minutes matched up with Russ a little bit more. So I think they found a formula to do a little bit better. I think if they go home, I like them to win game three. I don't think they're winning the series, but this has not been that different, really, of a series than what I necessarily expected it to be so far. It was just that OKC's strategy was so bad in game one that I think that kind of really limited them. Whereas now, you know, this is a competitive loss for them on the road against a good team, you know, nothing to hang their heads over.
This made me much more confident that this could be a longer series. Like after game one, you're sitting there going, oh, how is OKC going to put this together other than Russ just having a magnificent game, which he is always capable of. But here you saw some of the defensive elements a little bit earlier. Of course, Harden getting to the line so much is certainly a concern of theirs moving forward. But I saw more of, as you said, more of how Oklahoma City could win a game or two, maybe three. I don't think so. I think this is more like a six game series, but how they could do that as opposed to just being like, oh, this is not a no chancer, but a low chance series.
Yeah. I mean, I think the next thing they got to do is just, you know, keep Harden to like 10 free throws a game instead of like 15 or 20. You know, if they could do that, I think that they actually, as I mentioned, I thought they have some of the personnel to slow this Rockets team down, and they did well in that at times. So I think there's some hope for OKC. I mean, they're not going to win the series, but they can at least make it more competitive, I would say.
Sure, and I wonder, I'm excited to see whether Clint Capella doing so well in that fourth quarter, if that will carry over to game three, because he can be an X factor for them in the second round if they face, assuming they're going to face the Spurs.
Yeah, I think that's right, you know, with his athleticism, some offensive rebounding, getting up for some alley-oops in the pick and roll. I think that that's something that the Spurs could struggle with as well. So I think that's all I have on this one. We'll get to Atlanta and Washington momentarily, but first this from a new sponsor, audible.com. It just so happens, actually, that I have been using Audible basically continuously since about 2005. And that's because audiobooks are fantastic. I mean, really, the same reason that you love podcasts, audiobooks are great. I had a commute. I had, you know, chores to do, and being able to listen to a book during that time, you know, you can enjoy a walk in the park. You enjoy a twist in the plot. And I've always really enjoyed it, especially because I'm listening to a couple of books right now. Actually, I just listened to Brian Windhorst's book, Return of the King, on Audible. That was really good. The dulcet tones of Windhorst himself actually read that book. And there are a lot of actually really talented, Windhorst, sadly, you know, maybe not quite among them, really talented audiobook readers as well. So that adds like a different element of it as well. Like I remember I listened to Harry Potter back in the day, and it was read by a guy named Jim Dale, and his Hermione was pretty funny, as I recall. But nonetheless, Audible is just a great way to listen to books, especially if, like me, a lot of times you just don't have time to read when you're at home. home, or, you know, I'll be so tired after this, I try to read and I fall asleep. So it's good to be able to get away from the podcast world, escape into the sci-fi, which is what I mostly like to listen to. And the way to get started with Audible, of course, audible.com/capspace is the URL to do that. And you can get a free trial. So there's no reason not to try it. They also have this great listen guarantee. If you decide you don't like the book, you can exchange it for any title, anytime, no questions asked. The other thing that I really like about Audible too, and forgive me for rambling, but I like the service, is if you, they're owned by Amazon. So if you're reading a book on a Kindle, it can actually sync up with this technology called Whisper Sync. So if you're reading a book on your Kindle and then you want to pick it up in the car as you're leaving in the morning, you can do that and it'll just automatically send you to the spot, which is pretty sweet. All right, audible.com/capspace again is that URL. Easy to remember because we talk about capspace all the time in the program. audible.com/capspace. Ah, yes. Atlanta and Washington. I think we saw a good reason why this series is on NBA TV.
You mean you don't like seeing a game that lasts forever because of incessant fouling?
Yeah, I mean, this was, like, this game lasted like 20 minutes too long, and I didn't really care for the way it was refereed, to be honest. I mean, the Hawks, 33 out of 38 from the foul line. The Wizards, 24 out of 33 for themselves. I mean, this is not like some Hawks team that has all these awesome creators who just blow by you at the basket and, you know, you have no choice but to foul them. And Paul Millsap in particular was just an eyesore in this game. I've been critical of Kevin Love's game, and Paul Millsap just one step behind him, just in terms of like not really getting by his guy. He'll face up, like not really have the guy beat. He'll kind of be on his hip, and then he's just like, oh, I'm going to try and go through his arm and get a foul. And he would either get a foul or commit a terrible turnover or like barf up a shot trying to get a foul. That was basically like all he was doing. And so Millsap did, I mean, you have to give him his due. He was effective. He had 27 points, 14 of 15 from the line, 6 of 14 from the field. But he also had 5 turnovers, which, you know, due in part to a lot of that call seeking behavior. And Dennis Schroeder had superficially a good game. He started off well, but ended only 8 out of 21 from the field for his 23 points. At least avoided turnovers, which was good. But I thought one of the keys to the game was the fact that the Wizards were able to just go under on him every time, and he was only 1 out of 8 on three pointers. There was a couple of times where when they went under, he was able to get up ahead of steam and blow by his guy, but those instances were pretty rare. And overall, it was just, you know, it was a game effort from a Hawks team that just, you know, I thought struggled pretty badly in game one and really struggled at time in this game too. But I mean, it's clear to me that Washington clearly has a lot more talent than they do. And really the biggest thing that kept the Hawks in it was Marcus Morris and Otto Porter combining for only 43 minutes due to really bad foul trouble for those two guys.
Yeah, they were both struggling throughout. And while the Wizards have gotten surprisingly good minutes from Jason Smith so far in this series, including a couple of nice stretches during this game.
At times, except when he was guarding Millsap, he couldn't stop following Millsap. I mean, but you know, that's a tough matchup.
It's a low bar, my friend. It's a low bar.
No,
but that's true. The Wizards' strengths are, you know, now that they got Bojan, I think they're better, a little bit better at the guard spots. Brandon Jennings has helped out. I thought they could have used more of Kelly Oubre in this game. I think it's just because of Atlanta's size, they're a little bit intimidated by that.
I mean, Oubre had 4 fouls himself. You're saying that's putting true. Oubre at the 4 more. Yeah, you know, I think they did do that.
They did it sometimes. I mean,
Smith. Yeah, Smith has to play backup center as well. He played 28 minutes, and Oubre was negative 10. Bojan sucked too. He was 1 for 7, and he's never any good on defense. They did get a big performance from Brandon Jennings though, which was key. He was +3, and he hit like 3 tough step backs in a row, or 2 tough step backs in a row, and then was able to blow by his guy because he just made 2 shots and set up Smith for a dunk, which was a key stretch as Atlanta actually had taken a lead late in the third with all those guys in foul trouble, and then the Wizards, you know, surged back into control with a 35-23 fourth quarter after Atlanta had done the exact same thing, 35-23 to them in the third quarter.
We'll have to wait to know for sure until the game's in Atlanta, but every year it feels like there's one series that goes on way too long, and you know where it feels like, you know, how it's going to turn out earlier, but the other team is competitive, they play hard, and even though they don't have a great chance of winning the series, it ends up going like 6. I feel like that's going to be this series just because the basketball gods don't want me to be happy all the time. So
Atlanta Brooklyn, I thought, was that series series like in 2015.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, that went seven, right? Was it six or seven?
Yeah, and then it probably
felt like a lifetime.
That went six. Yeah, that was the series where Al Horford had five fouls, and so Budenholzer like left him out of the game until there was 30 seconds left in the game.
Yep.
Dwight Howard has not played well in this series. He was limited by his coach to 20 minutes. He was actually plus five, as it turned out. He was on the floor as they made a little bit of that run with some of the good guys for the Wizards out in the third quarter. But early on in the first quarter, they tried to post him up a couple of times, and he was just getting blocked by Gortat, or just, you know, throwing up terrible shots. He had three turnovers, four fouls. And defensively, I thought he was a liability because he was just used to be one of the best pick and roll defenders in basketball years ago, and those days are long behind him now because he just hangs way back in the pick and roll, and he's not interested in kind of fainting out and making someone feel him. Like, so if you get a good screen on and a lot of times it was Tim Hardaway in this circumstance, who I thought had a poor game as well. He couldn't get over a screen, and he finished a little bit hotter, but you know, it was way off for a lot of the game. But especially defensively, if that combination was just giving up wide open mid-ranges, we're talking about like 20 footers, we're talking about like from the free throw line, because Howard was hanging that far back, and those are really easy shots for any NBA player.
And I think that helped fuel some of what Beal did as well. And we also saw a little bit in this game of Bazemore playing the one, and he was part of the reason he got run out of Golden State, even though he did he had a nice role. He was popular among the team, was that they wanted him to be a primary ball handler, to be their backup point guard, and he couldn't do that. And he had some better stretches in this. I'm not trying to kill him for that, but it's just not his best role offensively.
Yeah. He gave up three pick sixes in this game, just turnovers where he either just threw it away or got stripped, and you know, it was just a layup for the other team. So that was not good at all. But I understand why Bud wanted to do that, because Calderon really is not any good defensively. I don't understand why they can't play Malcolm Delaney. Like, I thought he was fine. Like, he doesn't shoot very well from the field, but they always seem to play fine when he was on the floor this year. So I don't know why. And then they went to Calderon, who really just provides nothing defensively, and you know, he'll make a wide open shot, but that's about all he's got at this point, because he's a good passer, but he can't even like get even some modicum of penetration to like open anything up for his passes. I did think that the Hawks found a little bit with the lineup with Dunleavy at the three, Ilyasova at the four, and Muscala at the five, going against some of Atlanta's bench units. And that's a lineup that in theory has a lot of shooting on the floor. Dunleavy, oddly, only was given 6 minutes, most of it at the end of the first quarter. He was plus nine and then was never brought back in. Now, he didn't actually score, but he just moves the ball. He knows where to be. He provides some spacing. I mean, they really don't have a lot of shooting on this team. I mean, they're 4 out of 20 on three pointers in this game. Hardaway was 2 out of 4, and he's really the only guy that anyone respects from three on this team, other than maybe Dunleavy and Ilyasova. So I think they need to mix those guys in a little bit more. And meanwhile, Cephalosha, who, you know, was coming back from that groin injury, he only played 4 minutes in this one too, which was a little bit odd to see. I thought Torian Prince played well. At times he played 30 minutes in this one. Like, that's encouraging. But you know, he only took one three-pointer out of his eight shots. So they aren't getting enough spacing, especially when you consider that they can just go under on Schroeder whenever they want. And I mean, they're not going to get 38 free throw attempts in the next game.
Hopefully not.
John Wall was again spectacular in this one. 32 points and 9 assists on 27 shooting possessions and 4 turnovers, but not bad considering his usage. And then Brad Beal, 42 minutes, 31 points for him. So they combined for 63. Wasn't incredibly efficient, Beal, and he actually shot poorly from the free throw line, only 3 out of 6. But especially considering that Morris and Porter were able to play so little, that was huge. And then Marcin Gortat also blocked a ton of shots early in the game, had 6 offensive rebounds, including some key ones, and 14 points for him on 7 of 10 from the field.
I talked a little bit about how I don't necessarily want this series to go long, but how are you feeling as we move? I always feel like the 2-3 transition is an interesting one in a series like this, because you have a sense of where things are, but then you get, you know, a lot of advantages switching at the same time. My instinct is that Atlanta is going to pull at least one of these two at home, but I'm not sure it's going to be both.
Yeah, that seems right to me. I mean, they could, but I do think that especially down the stretch when the Wiz go to their starters against and you know who's going to close these games a lot of times. I mean, they closed it with Mike Muscala, who you know provided a little bit of something, but he's a poor defensive rebounder. Was 1 of 6 from the field today, and I mean he's not a starting caliber player. Decent for what he is. I think he should get an okay contract in free agency as a backup. But and then they haven't got much out of Howard. So Schroeder, I mean, he started 4 of 7, and then he ended the game 4 out of 14. Not a reliable shooter. I mean, Millsap is really kind of their only guy that you look at as really someone who is as good as any of the Washington starters. And while they do defend pretty well, the Hawks, they don't defend well enough against the, like that great Washington starting unit. And so, and this would have been a total blowout if Morris and Porter hadn't gotten into foul trouble. I mean, those guys were plus 16 and plus 19 in like 20 minutes apiece.
Yeah.
So I could see this being a sweep. And frankly, I hope that it is because we talked about this when we were watching the game together at Oracle. I mean, I hope that Paul Millsap ends up somewhere else.
It isn't as stark for me, mostly because it's one guy versus a couple, as the idea that has also been articulated about the Clippers being more interesting if their guys are on other teams. But Millsap on this team, we know what that is. And different combinations, I've talked about the idea of him being on Denver as intriguing just because he still has defensive value. And I think that fit with Jokic sure. would be exciting. But the Hawks are just kind of they're in this place. And it's concerning because they also have a fair amount of money, not an obscene amount of money, but a fair amount of money committed to those other players and what they need beyond those guys. And so I'll use that to talk about Schroeder, Bazemore, and Howard are probably the most prominent guys that they have long-term money tied up in. What you need outside of them is basically everything that makes a team exciting.
Yeah, that's true. And I think, you know, Prince really impressed me. Like
yeah, I like him.
He had some nice finishes. His athleticism was good. He had a couple of plays where moving his feet, he really cut guys off impressively to the point where you think maybe he could even like you could put him on point guards at times if you wanted to. So that's nice. But you know, Prince is never going to be a star. And I do think Coach Bud, because he's a coach, they almost need to be just like shocked into realizing that, hey, oh yeah, I know you were the fifth seed, but you had the worst point differential of any playoff team, and you're not close to doing anything, and you're not going to have any cap space if you re-sign Millsap. So guess what? Like, you need to rebuild. I know you're like all worried about your market, like they're not going to support you or whatever, but you know, you can't, I mean, they're probably, if they continue down this path, unless Schroeder can take like a monster step forward next year, it's hard for me to imagine them even necessarily being a playoff team. And so I think they need to just kind of be shocked into, hey, we got to really go down a different path now. I mean, they've kind of been able to reload and keep finding guys, but you know, they just don't have enough star power. And what star power they do have is Paul Millsap, and you know, he's going to be 32. And so you can't, I mean, I think they need to trade Howard while they can, and they need to move on from Millsap and then just see what they can kind of fill in around those guys and get a little higher in the draft, try to get some prospects.
Can you imagine being the coach / GM of this team and trading away everybody so what you're left with is Dennis Schroeder? Like, yeah, has anybody made their own life more miserable than that would do?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I might even try to trade Schroeder if you can, but you know, I mean, he is on a cheap-ish contract if somebody believes him, but you know, I'm not sure who that would be. So enough about that. I mean, I do think that the Hawks are very likely to lose this series, and I think it'll probably go 5 would be my pick for it at this point. But yeah, it's not looking good for them, and I frankly, it's gotten to the point where, you know, I do think that Bud gets a lot out of these guys, but you know, I don't really enjoy watching them that much. I mean, especially because, you know, they give it to Millsap and his attempts to create. I mean, he's just not that player who's should be creating one-on-one, and but you know, they need him to do that, and that's why you lead to this kind of, you know, either foul or screw up approach really from him, it seems like. So all right, let's move on to Golden State and Portland, but first this from CISO. CISO will put you on the guest list for exclusive comedy shows from today's top talent. Of late, they have new specials from Sashir Zamata and Gina Yashir. So you get a lot of these exclusive shows. You also get unlimited access to Late Night, The Next Day, British Cult Comedy, and Binge-Worthy Classics. This is what I like the most about it. 42 seasons of SNL, all 42 seasons, and the entire Monty Python catalog. In fact, the copy that they gave me is highlighted in blue. No yellow! You can also get access to tons of CISO original series, Harmon Quest, bajillion dollar properties, all on demand and commercial free. You can access them anytime, anywhere, on almost any device. And it's much more economical than any other streaming service, just $3.99 a month. You can get brand new stand-up specials or some of your favorite sets from favorites like Louis C.K., Amy Schumer, and Hannibal Buress. Well, you get started with them, CISO.com, S-E-E-S-O.com. Right now, and you can get 2 weeks free using the promo code CAPSPACE at checkout. Easy to remember, CAPSPACE, because we talk about it all the time. On the program, that's CISO.com, S-E-E-S-O.com, promo code CAPSPACE. So my biggest takeaway from this Golden State-Portland game, I don't know if you agreed with this while you were watching it. I've never seen, and especially because Portland has some really good offensive players, I've never seen a team that like wasn't playing hard enough on offense until today. And it really seemed like that. It seemed like Portland just like wanted these possessions to be over as fast as possible. Like they weren't really working for good shots. They were trying to run all their flare screen stuff and Golden State was just shutting it down. And, you know, CJ was throwing some pretty like lazy passes. Like he had this one just left-handed pass that he just threw out of bounds, sort of like wasn't even really like engaged in the possession. Like Dame Lillard pulled up for some really bad threes, including one memorable series where he pulled up for a 30-footer that just bricked off like the heel of the rim and like the backboard. And then Steph came down and was like, oh, no, this is actually how you pull up from 30, and he made it. But it really looked like a demoralized Blazers group. And that was a surprise to me because I felt like they could have a chance in this one, especially on offense, with a bunch of the Warriors' wing-sized guys out of the game.
My interpretation was that it was more an execution issue than an effort issue. Like, they just had some bad passes. Like, the one that I thought of was, I can't remember who was posting up, and Al-Farouq Aminu had to do the entry pass and just completely messed it up. And I can understand why Al-Farouq Aminu would not be great at that. It's not something that he's been asked to do a ton in his career off the top of my head. But I think that the narrative of this game was strange and surprising because this looked like a real chance for Portland. I mean, they had a close game. Yeah, they got incredible performances in game one from Lillard and McCollum, but the Warriors were playing not only without Kevin Durant, but without Matt Barnes and without Sean Livingston. And so kind of thought, okay, well, they're putting a lot of strain. The expectation was, you know, oh, they're going to put a lot of strain on Steph. They're going to put a lot of strain on Klay, a lot of strain on Draymond and Iguodala, presumably all of those guys. None of those players played more than 31 minutes in this game. And partially that's because it was over by the start of the fourth quarter. But there were two kind of definitive stretches of this game. One was after the Blazers took a 9-2 lead, the Warriors went on a 20-2 run where you're just kind of sitting there going, oh yeah, this is the team that we thought they could be. They looked like that a lot of the time when Durant was out, actually. And then the other one was just that third quarter where Portland, and they needed a couple late baskets to get here. They got to 12 points. It was a 28-12 quarter. And while this is not a Warriors podcast, I just like this little piece of trivia that it's tied for the least points the Warriors have allowed in a quarter of a playoff game ever with a definitive quarter on their way to the 75 title.
Yeah, that's actually, this isn't a Bulls podcast either, but that was the Bulls had a lead in that and ended up, I watched that one time and, you know, like Jerry Sloan is known as like, just like such a heady player, and he just like barfed up a bunch of like really terrible shots. I'm stealing that term, by the way, from Zach Lowe, especially talking about shots when players are just like trying to get fouled on jumpers. But he and Norm Van Leer just took a bunch of like terrible shots as they ended up losing that game on the road. And the legendary story behind that from Sam Smith is that Dick Motta, the coach at the time, after that game was over, they lost it on the road, blamed, I think it was Bob Love and Norm Van Leer for holding out at the start of the year. And he said, if those guys didn't hold out, we would have had home court. So look at those guys for why we lost. Unsurprisingly, that Bulls team was never really heard from again because they all just hated Motta. But that's an aside. One thing that really stuck out for me the most in this game was the Blazers 7 out of 34 three-point shooting. And the guys that I knew they're gonna, and they hit a couple early, but in general these guys were going to be allowed to shoot threes. It was Mo Harkless, 1 out of 5. Evan Turner, 1 out of 4. Al-Farouq Aminu made his first one, but was 1 out of 3. Alan Crabb, who actually, you know, you would think would make those shots, he was 3 for 10, 0-5 from three, only had 6 points. You know, he is someone who has to play well in this series, especially if they're going to play small. I mean, and that's the other problem for the Blazers that stuck out to me was, Noah Vonleh was negative 29 in 19 minutes. And, you know, really was probably negative 29 in about 10 minutes because he played a lot of garbage time as well. And so they're able to get back into it with Harkless and Aminu at the 4 and 5. But, you know, you had to play their centers at some point. And, you know, that those guys are just massive liabilities against this Warriors team. And that also throws out to me, just, you know, Noah Vonleh actually like played some pretty good games down the end of the season. And it's just such a step up in competition, not only against the Warriors, but just in general in the playoffs, that, you know, guys' weaknesses get exacerbated. And this is something that you said a lot, where, you know, it seems to me like the regular season sometimes is about guys' strengths, and then the postseason is about guys' weaknesses sometimes.
It certainly can be true. And one of the most surprising developments for me, even though I've watched so much of this team, has been that JaVale McGee's defense has gotten way better. You know, it wasn't great all of game one.
Shockingly better, yeah.
And his rim protection was good. He was better in terms of his pick and roll. And the idea, you and I have talked about it at length, you know, even though we only talk about the Warriors sparingly on Dunked On, that JaVale McGee's offense, the team was so good there that it superseded his defensive shortcomings. And as that calculus has shifted, he's become a more and more valuable player. And then the other guy who I feel like we need to discuss from this game, crazy that it's not any of their three All-Stars, though all of them were fine, was Patrick McCaw. McCaw got the start instead of Durant. And in this particular series, in this particular matchup, he fits in well because he can guard either of their stars, and then that can move Steph Curry into some other spots, and he didn't have to get into foul trouble.
It was easily the best game of McCaw's career to me. He played, although he did play garbage time, what I'm sure is a career high 34 minutes, and wasn't incredibly efficient. He took a couple of shots in garbage time too, but plus 27 for McCaw, which was the third on the team. And on both ends, he was very impressive. On defense, especially, he switched on to Dame Lillard, and McCaw has some really quick feet, great hands, as we know, great anticipation. There was one play where Lillard blew by him, and McCaw came back and just like blocked his shot in the air, like very impressive play. And I was standing next to McCaw as he was being interviewed in the locker room, and I, you know, he's always, when you're in the locker room, it's kind of hard to see how tall guys are sometimes, because, you know, they're just kind of like leaning over in their locker or something. You don't stand right next to him. Like, he's like a legit probably 6'5" and a half, or probably like 6'6" and a half, 6'7", and he's got pretty long arms. And I also was really impressed with him offensively in a couple of ways. You know, we fretted a little bit about his three-point shooting, but he showed impressive explosion to the rim in this one, like impressive acceleration. And, you know, obviously it wasn't a Blazers team that had a ton of rim protection. Aminu and Harkless actually did a great job in the first half, combining for 5 blocks, but after that weren't able to do much. And so McCaw's ability to turn on the jets there was impressive. And then he also had another play where he cut in the lane on CJ McCollum and faked him out of his shoes with a pump fake and scored over him. And actually, the soft-spoken McCaw had a little bit to say to CJ after that too. So it was, you know, I think overall it was a very demoralizing loss for the Blazers. You know, Dame Lillard said afterwards that, yeah, you know, it's 2-0. They don't count the score of these first two games. But I think the Blazers had some confidence after the first game because Dame and CJ played so well, and they felt like, hey, at least, you know, we might lose, we might be outgunned in this series, but we're at least going to like go down guns blazing, and like us two are going to play really well, and we can feel good about that. And then in this game, they combined for 9 out of 34 from the field and only 23 points after putting up 75 combined points in the game one.
In game one, Portland had 88 points at the end of the third quarter. In this game, they had 58.
Yeah, a 73 offensive rating through three quarters for the Blazers.
Damn.
So yeah, and part of it again was some bad Blazers offense. Part of it was just not making shots. But I thought they, especially in the first half, they defended pretty well.
Yeah, I thought so too.
And the Aminu and Harkless were heroic, but you know that couldn't be sustained in that third quarter. But considering like the number, yeah, go ahead.
Something else we should mention is that Aminu basically pulled a Mirotić in that first half, where he didn't start the game and then played almost the entire rest of it.
Yeah, I think he played 17 straight minutes, and then Sots didn't go that way once it kind of got out of hand in the second half. What did you think of Steph Curry's game? I thought it was just about as aggressive as I've ever seen him, and not necessarily to his credit, although he still, of course, was a game high plus 32.
Yeah, he was certainly aggressive in terms of looking for his own shot. There were a couple of moments that looked, you know, kind of like the last couple of years where he was trying to like shake and bake on a guy and then ended up pulling up. Sometimes he would drive, but usually he would pull up. One where he basically looked off and opened Klay Thompson in transition and made the three. But I also thought defensively he was more engaged, and also because he spent a little bit less time on Lillard and McCollum, was making less stupid fouls and was doing a better job. There was something that I was listening to in the postgame. They were talking about the idea of space and that they were giving the Blazers less space, particularly their guards. And while Curry is not the Warriors' best defender by a long shot, I thought he did a much better job of that, whereas in the first game, he helped create some of the seams that they used to their advantage.
Yeah, that's so too. And then Zaza Pachulia also was excellent in this one. He was 5 of 5 from the field during the competitive portion of the game, and in his minutes they played pretty well also, so getting what they did from he and McGee, who I agree, I mean, the way he's protected the rim in these first two games has been the best I've ever seen from him. I was critical of his ability to protect the rim all season, and how he just, you know, never seemed to live up to his tools. Just guys in his vicinity were just able to score, like most recently Shelvin Mack in that game against the Jazz scored over him at the rim like 5 times, but in this game he's been so fired up. I mean, he's someone who I thought the playoff crowd was pretty good today in Oracle. I thought he was someone who really benefits a lot from that and plays harder in those circumstances, and it helps him. And it helped too that he could just guard Aminu or Vonleh. Neither of those guys are really a shooting threat at all, and that's really his biggest problem, is he can't, you know, guard anybody on the perimeter.
Yeah, this is a rosier matchup in that sort of way. I mean, you do worry about his coverage on the guards. He's done a better job than expected, but never know if that's going to carry over to the next series, assuming the Warriors make it, which I think is a fair assumption right now. And another thing that I don't think we have to talk about this long, I've talked about a little bit on Locked On Warriors, is that I feel like the dominance of this win makes it less likely that that Kevin Durant will play in game three. I don't know. The injury will always take precedent.
Yeah.
And, you know,
Tim Kawakami reported as much, actually, that he said that Durant, you know, very well could not play in game three. And we didn't see, I was at practice today. They had like these like blinds down in the training room where they normally you can just see in there. So I think he probably was getting work done. We didn't see him out on the floor at all doing shooting. So it was very clear that he was going to get ruled out. Sam Amick reported that earlier in the day, and it just felt like that too. And then, you know, we didn't really even see him around. He wasn't on the bench either. So you have to wonder about, you know, maybe he's getting treatment or something, but you have to wonder about him for game three. They do have 2 days off, but there's no reason to bring him back. And of course, you know, we said that calf injuries can, of course, linger.
And the Warriors are very familiar with the idea of being patient with their guys and having faith in it. And we'll see if Yusuf Nurkic comes back. This also, to me, affects that logic. I've talked about the importance of that first summer in a new system. If what you're trying to do with Nurkic is give your home crowd a boost and maybe pull one or maybe even two games in the series, I don't think that's enough of an upside, personally.
I agree with you. And I mean, after they just got smacked in this game, I think they're under no illusion. Now, I do think Nurkic, especially if the Warriors are Livingston, Barnes, who I saw walking around the locker room, he was still walking with a limp, it looked like, as well. So, you know, I wouldn't say get a feeling that his return is necessarily imminent either. But, you know, Nurkic could help them so much offensively because they just have no bigs who can finish in the paint on the pick and roll right now. And no bigs who even can set a good screen either. You know, Nurkic sets great screens, and especially when Pachulia or McGee is in the game, I think they could help Dame and CJ put those guys under a lot more pressure in the pick and roll. So maybe he could help them, and, you know, I would be shocked if they win more than one game at home, and then, you know, they're going to get closed out in five, you would think, almost certainly. So I agree. I mean, with his injury history, his size, his importance to the franchise going forward, you know, it's kind of just like not really worth it, frankly. You know, for a guy with a fracture in his tibia, you know, do you really want to go down that road of you know, lower body stress fractures with a big who weighs, you know, 275 pounds.
Agreed.
All right, we're done here?
Yeah, but we should tell people about that we're going to do the Twitter NBA show second screen for tomorrow's action, which is fun because the game we're both looking forward to the most is the game that's on NBA TV, but you can still follow along with us. Okay, then that game is the Raptors Bucks game, which I'm actually really pumped for. I think that could be a really fun one.
Yeah, that series has been very enjoyable to me so far. A lot of players that I like watching in that series. And also, we'll be back Saturday and Sunday as needed. I mean, if there's going to be four games on each of those days, you know, we'll probably do a similar schedule to what we did last week, where and with the Warriors on the road, neither of us are going to Portland, so we'll be able to check in with you live on video throughout Saturday and Sunday as well. Friday we will be taking off, however, and there will of course be a Dunked On tomorrow night as well. So thanks so much for listening. Our sponsors today: audible.com/capspace to start your free trial, and CISO, use that capspace code to get 2 weeks free, and then only a mere $3.99 per month thereafter, with CISO, SEESO. Talk to you all next time.